Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Welcome to this or last week's live stream. We're running a little late. I was at the Collective Mastermind group outing with my good buddies, Jason Hartman, Kenny McElroy. They're the guys that I started the mastermind with, and we've got about 40 incredible members who are out in Naples, Florida. So I didn't have time to do it Sunday night, but now I am in Colombia, in Medellin, back where I started the YouTube channel, and got through the old medicine mandate. I've got a investor visa, so they're able to let me in without having the medicine, and so far, so good. They've got some crazy laws here that I don't like, obviously. But I'm here just to hire some more editors so I can create some more great content for you guys. And hopefully when I'm here over the next month or so, those restrictions will subside. The good news is people here just don't really pay any attention to the restrictions. Whatever the restrictions are, they're not paying attention to them. And you know what I find fascinating is before I came down, I was asking my research assistant, or I'm sorry, my admin assistant, Adriana. And I said, well, how's it going down there with the, you know, do they make you wear masks or whatever? She says, well, the government has a mask mandate for outside. Oh, ridiculous. And already it just sounds like a nightmare. She goes, but no one wears them inside, just outside. I'm like, what? Shouldn't it like be the opposite? And she goes, well, the law is that when you go inside, you can take it off because you're eating or doing whatever. Like, okay, that doesn't make any sense, but fine. So now that I'm down here, I get it. I totally get it. Because the law is technically that you have to wear it outside. No one wears it. They just wear it like right around their chin, like a chin strap, the people who do wear it. And, you know, there's maybe 50% of the people around my area that are wearing it. Almost that many people were wearing it in Arizona, where I was, outside, and there isn't a law. They're doing it voluntarily. But I figured the reason is because most people around here are poor by U.S. standards. A lot of the people out in the streets and, you know, that aren't in cars and whatnot. And it is a small fine if you get, technically it's a small fine. The cops really don't do anything. But I think that they're poor and they just don't want to get the $20 fine or whatever it is. But then when they go indoors where you can legally take it off and no one's going to write you a ticket, then no one's wearing them at all. So it's just a weird kind of dynamic, but it's definitely not enforced, which is nice. And I'm optimistic that within the next month or so, they'll really start to backpedal. So anyway, that's kind of what's happening. Boots on the ground here. Another thing that I went over that might interest all you guys before I get into the questions is inflation here is bananas. It's, you know, we think that inflation is kind of just in the United States, but it's everywhere in the world. And that's the first thing that my staff told me when I got here is everyone, where it was Angie, Joaquin, Adriana, Thomas, Danny, these are my editors, and, you know, Angie and Joaquin manage my real estate down here. They said, oh my gosh, prices are up. Groceries, food costs are up. They said the cost of materials are up. This is up, this is up. And they are experiencing significant consumer price inflation here, just like they are in the United States, which first thing that came to my mind is the 1970s, because the inflation of the 1970s was a global phenomenon. It was not exclusive to the United States or the UK. So I'm not saying that the setup is exactly the same as the 1970s, but some of what we're seeing definitely rhymes. So we'll have to pay attention to that more moving forward. Now, on the flip side of that coin, it looks like the yield curve is starting to flatten even more. And I know a lot of you say, George, what are you talking about? The 10-year has gone from 1.7 to 1.9 over the last couple of weeks. You would be right, but the 2-year has gone up in lockstep. So it's if the Fed continues or tries to raise rates, it'd be very interesting to see if we get that inverted yield curve. And if we get that inverted yield curve, that means that we will most likely get a recession. Then the next question becomes, you know, what happens to asset prices and what happens to the economy, inflation, disinflation as a result? All these things we got to think through. But let me get into your questions, because I'm sure a lot of you are probably talking about this in the chat. Oh, and by the way, I'll probably do a meetup down here. And when I've got one scheduled, obviously I got to find a hotel that doesn't require masks or anything like that, which actually shouldn't be too hard. I'm not really worried about that. But we'll get like a ballroom and get it catered, or go to a bar or something like that. I'll let you guys know if and when we do a meetup down here in Medellin. Okay, let's see what we got. Hopefully we got some questions on the truckers. I'm really glad to see them doing what they're doing and standing up for freedom and liberty and all those good things. I talked about that extensively with Robert Barnes today. If CPI comes in softer than expected, dodgy dated, watch your BLS video. It was great. Thanks, Peter. Actually, that's tomorrow's whiteboard video on the George Gammon channel. It's going to be on the changes to the CPI. I'm sure most of you guys have heard that the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is changing their methodology for calculating CPI. Shocker, right? And but what's very difficult is to find information on what they're changing specifically. They're actually changing the weighting for the CPI inputs. And they don't go into specifics, but I tried to do as much digging as I possibly could. I probably was digging about 3 or 4 hours today. And I was able to come to some conclusions that I think will shed light and reveal to all you guys what their methodology will be moving forward, and if that will understate the level of headline CPI even more than it's already understated. Spoiler alert, yes. let's see. What are the chances of the Fed taking a wait and see approach, believing bond markets are? Yeah, I mean, if that, they're paying attention to the yield curve, Peter. They've got to be. If they're not, they're crazy. And if they start seeing that yield curve flatten out, I just, they're in a very unenviable position. That's for sure. I don't know what I would do. Well, I know what I would do. I would just let the free market do what it wants to do. But yeah, they're really backed up into a corner here. And if the yield curve continues to flatten, especially after they raise rates in March, assuming they do, the stock market doesn't like that. I don't know. That's we've talked about this conundrum quite a few times over the last month or so, maybe even 2 months, maybe even longer than that, on the George Gammon channel and the Rebel Capitalist channel, that the Fed has painted themselves into a corner. And what they're doing in all the government deficit spending, the CARES Act, etc., this works okay. I'm not saying it's optimal. I think it's a terrible policy. But if your objective is just to kick the can down the road, regardless of how detrimental it is to the long-term health of the economy and society at large, if your objective is just to kick that can down the road, then you can get away with doing what they have done since 2008, as long as inflation is low, at least by headline CPI. If inflation starts getting 6, 7, whatever, 8%, it's a whole different ballgame, especially when you consider the fact that the politician's number one goal is to be reelected, and there's nothing that can reduce their probabilities of being reelected faster than consumer price inflation. And then you say, well, George, what happens if the stock market goes down? What happens if the Fed is able to stick the landing and bring CPI from 7 down to 3? Or what if this new methodology that you're talking about, George, just brings down headline CPI, even though the real inflation in the real economy with consumer prices is far higher? Well, my rebuttal would be, I don't think that matters to voters, because voters, let's just say that they squash inflation completely tomorrow and they go to vote. I'm not sure when the midterms are, this year sometime, and they go and the voters go to vote. They're not going to remember the fact that, oh, well, the price I pay for beef hasn't moved up in 2 months. Therefore, oh yeah, I want to still vote for these guys. No, no, no. They're going to think back and say the price of beef was $5 a pound a year and a half ago. Now I'm paying $10. And even if it's been $10 for 3 months and hasn't gone up, I don't think that's going to matter to the voters. They're still going to be pissed. And the average Joe and Jane out there might not be like the Rebel Capitalist community. They might not understand quantitative easing like you guys do. They might not understand the repo market. They might not understand sound money or gold or Bitcoin or commodities or the Fed's balance sheet or government deficit spending or how dollars are created. They might not understand this stuff like we do. But the one thing they do understand is when they go to the grocery store, is the cost of beef double what it was a year ago? When I go to put gas in my car, is it double what it was a year ago? Is my rent 30% higher? They do understand that. And that's how they vote. I think that supersedes Democrat, Republican. For most people, I don't think that matters. I think it usually matters quite a bit. But when it comes to what they're paying at the grocery store, when it comes to inflation, I think Democrat, Republican takes a back seat. So that's why I say consumer price inflation is really kryptonite to these politicians. And they realize that. So I think they might kind of be in a position where, especially if the yield curve continues to flatten, where the stock market is collapsing, consumer prices are still high, at least high enough to where people are pissed off at the politicians. And they have to make a decision. They say, well, would we rather have a crashing stock market or would we rather have inflation? Pick your poison. So that's when I think they'll move to price controls, but we'll have to see how that plays out. Now, as far as the Fed taking a wait and see approach, I think they might, Peter, but the politicians, they want to make it seem like they're doing something. And if, let's just say the Fed comes out in March and says, oh no, we're not going to hike rates, and people continue to see the prices of the stuff that they pay or they buy daily go up, then they're going to be pissed off the politicians. And you know the other side of the aisle is going to say, oh, well, listen, the Fed should have raised rates. And those other guys or gals, they didn't want the Fed to raise rates. It's their administration. They're going to try to blame them. So it's a very precarious position, to say the least. And I don't see how they thread this needle. Who knows? We'll have to see how it plays out. It's definitely an environment that reminds me a lot of that Lenin, or the quote from Lenin. And I was using this a lot in 2020 and 2021 in regards to our personal freedom and liberties. But I think it might be even more applicable to the economy and global macro in 2022. And so that saying is, there are decades that go by when nothing happens. And then there's weeks that go by where decades happen. I think we saw that in terms of the attack on our personal freedoms and liberties in 2020 and 2021. And I think that saying, that quote, is going to be just as applicable, if not more applicable, to the economy in 2022. We're going to see fireworks, in my opinion. That's obviously no certainties, only probabilities, but that is my base case. I would be shocked if we didn't see some serious fireworks, or volatility, maybe that's a better way of saying it, if we didn't see some serious volatility in 2022. So the question is, have I seen the JRE clip with Eric Weinstein about CPI? Also, is centralized share ownership a nothing burger? Do you see value in direct share purchase programs? So, number one question, I did not. I really like Rogan. I think he's in a tough position right now with Spotify. I don't know the guy. So, although he was extremely nice to me, in the sense when the Rebel Capitalist channel got taken down, he retweeted that to YouTube to show his support for bringing the channel back. Which I think when the channel was reinstated, which happened about 2 hours after Rogan retweeted that initial tweet that I sent out, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he got involved. So, I owe him a lot of gratitude for kind of standing up for me, although he doesn't even know me. I'm guessing maybe he watches some of my whiteboard videos, but I've never talked to Joe. I've got a ton of respect for him. I wish he would not have apologized the other day. But I'm sure he has his reasons, and I'm not walking in his shoes. So I don't know what, you know, I don't know what's coming at him. I don't know what his game plan is. I can't get into his head. So I can't say whether it was, you know, who am I to say whether it was right or wrong? Joe felt it was right to do, so that's what he did. I hope he comes out ahead as a result, because I do think he's a genuine guy, and I think the world needs him, especially in this battle for the truth, the battle against censorship, and the battle for freedom, liberty, and free market capitalism. But like I said, I wish he would not have apologized, but again, I don't know his rationale. There could be some reasoning that I don't know about that's happening behind the scenes. You never know what's happening behind the scenes. And if I understood everything that was happening behind the scenes, I may come to a different conclusion. But I wish him all the best. And I was listening to a clip from Jordan Peterson today, talking to Patrick Bet-David, who's someone that I've interviewed. I've interviewed Patrick. He's a great guy. And Dr. Peterson was saying that he would be shocked that if Rogan just ignores this stuff and just, you know, kind of water off the duck's back. He's saying he's shocked if he wouldn't have 20 million viewers per episode in about a year or a year and a half. So, and I hope he does. So, but my point there is a big fan of Joe's, haven't seen the clip. I'm a big fan of Eric Weinstein's as well. And a huge fan of Brett. So I did a virtual conference with Brett the other day for Dr. Chris Martinson. I didn't have the opportunity to say hello, but I look forward to meeting him one day and shaking his hand, because I think he's got his head on straight. He stands up for freedom and liberty, even though he might be, you know, he might have different political views than I do. You know, I wouldn't say I'm an extreme libertarian, but I'm a libertarian. Brett might be a little more progressive, which is fine. But I really respect his position through everything that's happened over the last couple of years. And obviously those two brothers are incredibly bright, and they just bring a ton of value to the world. And yeah, I can't recommend their content enough, but I'd love to hear what he said on the CPI. Cause I know Eric has a bit of a background in economics. I don't know. He might even have a degree in economics, but anyway, yeah, hopefully I'll have the opportunity to interview all three of those guys in the near future. I'd love to interview Joe. I'd love to interview Eric. And I'd love to interview Brett.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
Question, could you see the ratio of gold ounces needed to buy an average priced home in the U.S. change in favor of gold? Sure. Many money managers weren't alive in 1970s and aren't positioned for 1970s inflation. Well, let's go back to an earlier question that a gentleman asked on this live stream, basically referring to, you know, the Fed being offsides as far as their narrative right now. And maybe, you know, they're taking this hawkish stance, but what happens if they take a more dovish stance, if they look at the flattening of the yield curve or if the stock market tanks? You know, the market right now, I think, is expecting 3 rate hikes and probably some quantitative tightening in addition to taking tapering down to zero. If the Fed surprises on the dovish side that, oh, whoops, sorry, we're not going to do any interest rate hikes. Man, I mean, I'm not a market timer guy. You all know that. I'm not someone that tries to tell you the price of this is going up or the price of that's going up or buy this because it's going up or short that because it's going down. You guys know I don't do that. But I do try to answer the question, is something cheap or is it expensive? And I also like things that are unloved. And I think gold right now is unloved. And so I'm not buying it, but I'm definitely paying attention. And not just gold, but the gold miners as well. So this is not a prediction by any stretch. But if the Fed were to come out, let's say in March, and not hike rates, I think gold would respond favorably to that. So then the other side of the coin is, could housing come down? And the answer there is obviously yes. We're in a massive bubble. Prices are at all-time highs. I'm not saying that the nominal price is going to come down immediately. Nobody knows. The price could triple from here easily. Could home prices triple from here? Sure. Anything's possible. But I do know that it's expensive. So going back to what I said earlier, I like to buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. As most of you know, I built pretty much my entire U.S. real estate portfolio in 2012. And I haven't announced this officially, but I'll go ahead and do it right now, that as of last week, I no longer own any real estate in the United States. My agent, who's awesome, Kansas City, sold my very last house in the United States last week. So again, could home prices go up? Absolutely. I'm not saying we're at a top. I'm not even saying, you know, sell your house or do any of that stuff. So I'm not saying that nominal prices are going down. I'm just simply saying they're expensive. So if they're expensive, I don't care if they double. I don't care if they triple. Those are my rules. If it's expensive, I sell it. And so, if it's, you know, regardless of what type of price gains I miss out on, that's absolutely irrelevant to me. So, but I'm off on a tangent there. Could home prices in nominal terms go down? Yeah. I mean, look at that flattening yield curve and go back to 1950, pull up a chart, and you'll notice that every single time we have an inverted curve, 100% of the time we have had a recession. And on the flip side of that coin, we have never had a recession without an inverted yield curve, which I find almost even more fascinating. So we really need to be watching the 10-year treasury like a hawk. If the Fed does raise rates, what's the delta on Fed funds in the 2-year? Then the next question becomes, what's the delta between the 2-year and the 10-year? And if you see that thing invert, that's when I would... I wouldn't short the stock market. I wouldn't short the housing market, however you do that. I'd pay attention. I definitely wouldn't be aggressively buying. Let's just put it that way. That's when you're kind of, I think that's the Roadrunner cartoon where Wile E. Coyote has walked off or run off the cliff, and you all know that he's run off, the viewer knows that he's run off the cliff, but he doesn't know it yet. And it's just a matter of time before he looks down and he sees a drop. But also I want to point out that home prices could go down in real terms and not in nominal terms. I mean, you got to ask yourself what the true rate of inflation is. I mean, what would you peg it at? You know, if the CPI says 7%, I think most of the people on this live stream right now would say that it's probably closer to 12 or 15%. Okay, well, if it's closer to 12 or 15%, And let's say that home prices go up 5% for the next 2 or 3 years, and inflation is running at 15%, you're losing 10% per year, even though your home price went up. So that's another, people think about a housing crash as if prices crash down. Not always. Many times prices can crash up. That's exactly what happened in Venezuela. Home prices are way higher today than they were 10 years ago, but they can't buy as much stuff. The home prices are higher, but the purchasing power is far, far lower. And you don't care about the price. You just care about the purchasing power. So it's not a cut and dry question and answer when you're just trying to figure out, are home prices going up or down? There's a lot to unpack. And if you're not getting into the nuance, I don't think that you're properly assessing the probabilities. Okay, guys, bear with me, please. Here's another question. What are your thoughts on Rotan as a future resort tourism spot? I don't know where that is. Is that in Mexico? In Honduras? I don't know anything about that. I mean, I'd start by just asking if it's cheap, Matt. So, are prices depressed there compared to where they have been historically? And if so, why? Like, did they shut down and therefore tourism got crushed in 2020, and as a result, housing has really crashed? Or, maybe there's niche hotels, there, boutique hotels. Maybe they're having a hard time, so you might be able to get them cheap relative to their 2019 cash flows. I don't know if that's what you're looking at, but that's where I'd start. So I'd look at as an example, if I was looking at potentially buying a small hotel in Rotan, I'd say, okay, what were the cash flows in 2019? And then I'd look at the cash flows now. Obviously, I'd only be willing to give them a multiple on the current cash flows. I would not be willing to give them a multiple in 2019. I don't think any smart buyer would. And then I'd ask myself, what's the probability that we go back to 2019? I think pretty high, especially in countries like Honduras. And, then it's a matter of when. Then it's a matter of your staffing and all these other questions I'm sure that you've asked yourself already. But again, we start from what's the cash flow, and is it cheap? Can you get it at a cheap price? Can you buy a dollar for 50 cents? That's really what this all boils down to. A lot of people get confused about the word cheap. Like they think that, GameStop is cheap just because it's a lower price. Or, I was talking to the guys with the Fresh and Fit podcast the other day. I had a couple hours in Miami before my flight, so I was able to go over to their studio and do a podcast. And they're great kids, really, really great kids. I like them. They're friends of Rolo, and so that's how I met them. And I'm buddies with Rolo. Nowadays, I really don't do any interviews unless I know the people. And so I was happy to do their interview because of that intro through Rolo, and I know they're good dudes. But anyway, they're not as sophisticated when it comes to macroeconomics or anything like this, but they're really trying to learn. And I'm sure they will learn because they're very ambitious young guys. And but we were going through, buying things when they're cheap, and they thought that just meant buy the dip. And I think a lot of young people or kind of newbie retail investors think that when I say buy things when they're cheap, that just means buy the dip. And that is not what it means. It's not what it means at all. Let's look at a commodity as an example, oil. Oil is cheap below $30 a barrel, adjusted for inflation. Oil is expensive over $80 a barrel. So if oil goes from 90 a barrel down to 80, and that doesn't mean that it's cheap just because there's a dip in the price, it's still expensive. So I helped them kind of think that one through. But my point there is try to get in the mindset where you're buying a dollar, something that's worth a dollar based on its cash flows, not based on what you think the price is going to do. That's what most people do. They say, oh, well, this is cheap. By what metric? Because the company is going to grow so much, or electric vehicles are the future. therefore this is cheap based on XYZ happening in the future. No. That's not how you buy a business. At least when I was buying and selling businesses, or when I was in that world, that's not what you do. Listen, if you're out, just take it back to a McDonald's. Remember, guys, when you're buying stocks, you're buying a business. Just pretend like you're buying a Circle K, or you're buying a local dry cleaner, or you're buying a McDonald's, right? If you're buying a McDonald's that was netting $100,000 a year, but they are charging, let's say, $2 million, you're like, what? You're charging 20 times earnings for this McDonald's, and I don't even own the real estate? No, that's nonsense. And they say, oh, no, but it's cheap. What do you mean it's cheap? Well, it's cheap because in 5 years, they're going to come up with this incredible menu. And the menu is going to be so incredible at McDonald's that your cash flow is going to be $1 million. Therefore, if you're making $1 million in 5 years, then a price of $2 million today is cheap. What? Like, no, that's not how this works, right? No smart buyer would, in fact, a smart buyer would laugh that person out of the room. So the way it works is no, you're making $100,000 today. Therefore, based on a reasonable multiple, your business is worth, let's say, whatever, $800,000, or maybe a little bit of a premium because there's a McDonald's. So say it's worth $1 million, right? That's what your business is worth. Why? Because you're making 100 grand a year. I don't care what you're making in 5 years. Irrelevant. So I come from that world, right? So when I hear people say something is cheap because of something that's going to happen in the future, I just completely ignore that. Like, that just sounds like, it sounds like fool's gold to me. So my point there, and the main takeaway, for I think if you guys could get yourself in this mentality, it would help you out a lot. If you want to use some of my strategies, it's buy a dollar for 50 cents. You see, let's just say the market rate for that McDonald's was $1 million because it's throwing off 100,000 a year. You want to try to buy it for 500. See, you're buying something that is really worth right now, not in 10 years, right now, it's worth $1 million, but you're trying to buy it for 500. See, that's a dollar for 50 cents. Instead of what most people do is they try to buy a dollar for $3, hoping that it goes to $5. That's what most people do. They overpay for something and they rationalize it and tell themselves that it's cheap based on some fictional price that they think it may attain in the future. Again, for me, that's fool's gold. And there is no edge there. In fact, I think there's a negative edge. And if you continue to do that over the long run, you're going to go bust. If you do that, if you buy a dollar for 50 cents, I think that's a huge edge. And if you do that over the long run, in my, at least with my portfolio, what I've seen is I've made money. So will high paying dividend stocks be an effective inflation hedge? I think there's some merit there. Obviously not everyone, because you don't know what's going to happen with the dividend. But let's use the McDonald's again as an example. So if you've got a company like Tesla, let's say, and I don't want to pick on them, but that's kind of a good example here, because their valuation is based on something way, 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 way into the future. So their valuation has absolutely nothing to do with their current cash flows. So if Tesla was paying, let's say, a 1% dividend yield, okay, that's good, but that could be volatile. That could disappear very, very quickly. Compared to that McDonald's that is paying you $100,000 a year to own it, that cash flow is not highly volatile. That cash flow could be, quote unquote, recession-proof. If anything is recession-proof, a McDonald's is, other than a liquor store. If you own a liquor store, a McDonald's, and a strip club, you're going to be recession-proof. I guarantee it. but with owning Tesla, maybe not, right? So all dividend stocks are not created equal. But if you've got some good dividend paying stocks that are solid, like that McDonald's, then I do think it is a hedge, because the businesses are price makers. They're not price takers, although they do have input costs. I get it. But they can pass those costs on to their customers, especially companies that have customers that are almost addicted to their product, such as like Coca-Cola. So they've got a lot of leverage when it comes to pricing. So that's what you want. And also, if you're getting a dividends, one of the things I love about them is they offset the negative carry on your cash position. So let's say right now you've got a decent amount of cash because you think there's a 10, 20% probability that we could get some cheap stocks here in 2022 based on the flattening yield curve and what the Fed is doing. You realize there's a negative carry on that cash. But if 80% of your portfolio is paying you to own it, and remember, guys, that's why I set up the 10-80-10 portfolio. So 10% insurance, physical gold, 80% investing or investments. And I define that by things that pay you to own them. And then 10% speculative assets. They might not pay to own them, but there's good upside. There's good risk reward, good asymmetry. So if 80% of your portfolio is in dividend stocks or real, you know, positive cash flowing real estate that's paying you to own it, that's really offsetting the negative carry you have on cash. So that's a huge benefit. And then also too, if you're getting paid well to own 80% of your portfolio, then you're never going to be a motivated seller. Never. Because what do you care if the price goes down? Let's use the McDonald's as an example. Let's say you buy that McDonald's for $800,000 and it's paying you $100,000 a year. And in 5 years, it's paying you $125,000, maybe $150,000. But your broker comes to you in 5 years and says, "Oh, George, boy, wow, I've got some bad news." "Really? What's wrong, business broker?" "Well, you know, the Fed's raised interest rates. Therefore, the multiple on your cash flow for this McDonald's you own has gone down. And if you sold it today, you could only get $700,000 for it. And you paid $800,000 5 years ago." What? Why do I care about what the price of a McDonald's is right now, or the price that I could sell my McDonald's for? Who cares? I'm never selling it. Why would I sell an asset that's paying me $150,000 a year when my cost basis is only $800,000. I'd have to be a maniac, a lunatic to sell. What do I care what the price is doing? And if the price goes up, who cares? The business broker says, "Oh, the price has gone up to 1.5. So I could care less. You see, that's how, in my opinion, and this is how I personally try to look at stocks. I try to just look at them like I'm buying a McDonald's. And so that's why when people try to, you know, time the market, you know, the tops, the bottoms, or if I sell my real estate right now, they say, "Oh, aren't you worried that you're missing out on all these gains?" As what? That doesn't even compute. Like, that doesn't even make sense to me. Or why people would prefer to have, you know, this asset that isn't paying them anything to own it. And I don't know. I don't get that. So for me, I just want to buy the business, right? And I think that's, if you've got 80% of your portfolio paying you to own it, you never have to sell. And as long as those dividends keep coming in, as long as that rent keeps coming in, you're good to go.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com GeorgeGammon.com/pro. That's GeorgeGammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow rebel capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
Well, here's a good question. With the mandates now being lifted, how does that impact inflation, deflation? Well, Rigo, I think it's all about cross currents. And this is another way that I want to try to encourage you guys to think. And it's something that's really helped my thinking to a great degree. And that's understanding at all time, there are multiple cross currents affecting these macro events. So in this case, inflation, deflation. It's not that we have inflation happening right now or deflation happening. They're happening at the same time. We always have inflationary pressures and we always have deflationary pressures. It's a matter of getting into the nuance and determining what those influences are and which influences may overpower the others. Like I think of all these currents in the ocean. You know, you guys have seen those arrows and those, you know, pictures where they're not even just going, one's going this way, one's going this way. It's one's going this way and kind of curving up, one's going down and curving, and they're just going all over the place. But so that's kind of the way I see the macro environment with inflation and deflation and a lot of things, quite frankly. The dollar, I think, is another thing that I kind of see it as all these cross currents that are happening at one time. But the thing is, if you have a tidal wave, if you have a tsunami, as an example, even though all these cross currents are there, that tsunami completely overpowers them. So you've got to start by asking yourself, what is impacting the inflation and deflation that we are experiencing right now, because they're both happening at the same time. And then you say, okay, out of these cross currents, what do I think is going to overpower the others, if anything, in the future? And what would be the catalyst to one of these cross currents gaining more power? And then asking yourself, what is the maybe black swan event that would be the tsunami that would overpower everything else? A great example is the GFC. So if you were a real estate investor in 2006, you could know your local market better than anybody. You could know the school districts, you could know, you know, which areas are being gentrified. You could know where the young people want to live, where the starter homes are, where the A neighborhoods, the B neighborhoods, the C neighborhoods. You could know all of this stuff. And you could give me stat after stat after stat about the job growth, how the population is increasing, and all of these positive things that would be a cross current. That would be a tailwind for real estate in your local market in 2006. Absolutely. But if you're ignoring that tsunami that is mortgage-backed securities, or actually the Eurodollar market, but let's just assume, you know, we'll go with the mainstream narrative there of mortgage-backed securities. It doesn't matter how many great cross currents you have at a local level, because that tsunami is going to wipe you out. And that's that black swan event that I'm talking about. So you've got to understand everything. You've got to understand the cross currents at play, what may be overpowering the other cross currents at any given time and maybe into the future, but then also what could be this black swan tsunami that no one's paying attention to that could overwhelm everything else. So let's go through some of these cross currents with inflation, deflation regarding the mandates. If they are rolled back, which I think they probably will be. Again, I had a long discussion with Robert Barnes about this today. And he is under the impression that within 6 months, all mandates in the United States will be gone. And I said, even the passports in New York City and Los Angeles, he said, yep. And he said that very definitive. He did not hesitate at all. And Barnes has called a lot of what is happening right now. In fact, when Barnes came to my first mastermind meetup for the collective that I do with Kenny McElroy and Jason Hartman, the first one we did was a couple months ago in Scottsdale, and Barnes was nice enough to come speak there. And one of the things he said is that the mandates for the businesses in the United States, and this was when Biden first brought that up, that there's no way that would fly with the Supreme Court. And, you know, me, I was like, man, are you sure? Because it sure seems like it's going that direction. It sure seems like the administration will just influence the Supreme Court, just, you know, whatever. He's like, no, this is the way it works. And he walked it through, like, it'll do this. And because of this, this, and this, they're gonna knock it down. And sure enough, it played out exactly like he said, exactly to a T. So just because he was right there, I'm not saying he's going to be right about the mandates, but I think he's really got his finger on the pulse of what is going on. And so, and just FYI, I don't want to be a spoiler alert for our interview, which will be up on the George Gammon channel probably Friday. But he said the last thing that will probably go in the United States would be the masks in the airports and the planes. And then the very, very last thing that will go internationally will be the requirement for foreigners coming into the United States to have the medicine. So, but so kind of everything, the mask mandates go, the passports go, even within New York and LA and Oregon or whatnot. And then probably lastly, in the United States, we get the airports and airplanes gone with the masks. And then you'll most likely see them drop the whole medicine requirement for foreigners coming into the United States. He says once that happens with the U.S., he says then he thinks most of the other countries will follow suit. So I think for the, you know, and for certain, I don't know, for certain states, I think that will be inflationary. I think that's more on the demand side. For states like Florida, though, not really, because the Cervasa sickness, in my opinion, isn't impacting Florida at all. Although, okay, so that is, but and so my first cross current, yes, I think it will create some inflationary pressures in some states where the regulations and the restrictions have been very draconian because of the demand increase. On the flip side of that coin, I think it will be deflationary in some aspects because there's been just massive amount of business going to Florida, Texas, Arizona because of the restrictions elsewhere, and they have a very limited supply. I know this when I'm booking hotels for Rebel Capitalist Pro or Rebel Capitalist Live and the Mastermind Group. It's almost impossible, and the prices are astronomical. And so I think that if tomorrow we woke up and there were no mandates, then you'd have so many more options as to where to do your next live event, that it would decrease prices because we'd have supply, so much supply open up that isn't there today if you are an event that doesn't want to deal with masks, as an example, which a lot of events don't. That's why the prices are so high in Florida. So that would be a deflationary pressure. It's basically the, you know, the supply coming back online, kind of the supply chains. I don't want to say they're going to be fixed because I think that they've had structural damage that we're going to be paying the price for a long, long time. But those are just two examples of different cross currents that I think will be at play. And so I think that you, understanding that framework, you can go down and just list out the other cross currents that you think, and because there's going to be a lot of them there, and determine what you think has the highest probability of occurring. In my opinion, kind of my base case, I think we see CPI start to flatten out a bit, maybe even go down. It doesn't mean we have deflation. It just means we have lower increases. So instead of it being 7%, maybe it's 4%, 5%, something like that. Headline CPI, not real inflation. Now, as far as asset prices, though, that is a completely different story. You know, even during the GFC, there was only a few months span where the CPI was negative. Usually the even during the Great Depression, there was only a couple years. People think that the whole 1930s was deflationary as far as consumer prices. It wasn't. In fact, there were some years in the 1930s when inflation was pretty high, like 5-6%. It was just the first couple years of the 1930s. It's very difficult for consumer prices to go down for a variety of reasons. And that's why going back to the 1940s, if you look at a chart of inflation, there's only one or two little blips where you see prices going down, just one or two little bit, and then it just pops right back up and prices start going up again. And even in this low inflationary environment, quote unquote, that we've had since 2008, inflation's still been positive. Let's not kid ourselves. Prices aren't going down. Prices are just going up at a lower rate. So I see that potentially happen. And again, I'm talking about the next 6 months, a year. Long term, I think we're going to get way more inflation. But as far as asset price, I think there could be some downward pressure there because of what the Fed is doing or will do, assuming they raise rates and do quantitative tightening. Now, if they don't do QT, they don't raise rates, then it's a completely different set of probabilities and circumstances. And then I would say that inflation probably start ticking up again, and even from 7% CPI, and assets probably continuing to go higher. Gold price skyrockets in that environment, though. But then if the 10-year goes up, I think that will decrease the flattening or increase the steepening of the curve, and that would make a recession far less probable. And so, again, it goes back to really paying attention to that yield curve. George, what happens if something like the trucker thing causes Canadian dollar to go into – it won't. I think what the truckers are doing is fantastic. I think it's going to be hopefully a global movement. I mean, they've made a massive impact on what's happening in Canada. My hat's off to them. I wish them far more success. And I've heard of a trucker freedom movement starting up in New Zealand and all of these other countries, possibly even in the United States. And even Barnes was saying his rationale for places like Los Angeles and New York getting rid of their mandates is because he thinks the politicians there are scared of a trucker movement there, like Sacramento. And so he thinks that they're preemptively going to get rid of their restrictions so they don't have the next trucker movement in their capital city. And I think there's a lot of validity to that hypothesis. But no, you could see a lot more inflation in Canada, sure, because there's no goods getting to the stores. Therefore, you have supply going down, demand staying the same. That means price is going up. But does that cause hyperinflation? No. Remember, hyperinflation by definition is 50% per month, not per year. So no, what the truckers are doing, I think, is great from a standpoint of personal liberty and freedom, but it definitely will not create price increases of 50% per month. Although it may create some further supply disruptions and therefore some slightly higher prices. I shouldn't say slightly. I should say, price increases of, instead of 5%, maybe, 7-8%. Who's eating the prices where you are at? So I'm in Medellin right now. Your property renters, your staff, or are you, or all the above? Well, I can tell you, I had dinner last night with Angie and Joaquin, and I don't have any projects in the works right now. I do have properties here, but they're all rented out. And so they're not currently working on a project for me where they're actually buying materials. But I can tell you the buyer is going to eat the cost, the consumer is eating the cost. The businesses are just going to try to keep prices as low as they can. But at the end of the day, they're going to all raise prices because they have to have a certain margin to make it worth their while. So, and then that's going to trickle down to the renters, because if the home buyers are buying it for a rental property and, they're going to jack rents to try to get the yield they need based on how much out-of-pocket cost they have. And right now there's plenty of renters to pay. Rents are astronomical. I'm renting out my one property that's maybe 165 square meters, maybe one, or actually, no, I'm sorry. It's more than that. It's, 189, I think, something like that. But I'm renting out for $3,000 US per month, $3,000. And you guys in the US right now may say, oh, George, that's nothing. Who cares? No, in Medellin, Colombia, that's a lot of money. And so when I first bought the property, I thought I might be able to rent it out for maybe $2,500, something like that. So, 3,000. That's a good increase. So rents are up. I mean, everything is up here. Even the food costs are up. So that's going to be the consumers. Now, as far as me personally, it hasn't affected me. So why? Because I'm not going to say I was smart or anything. I just happened to have set things up to where I was playing kind of a geo arbitrage game. So what is that? That's where your expenses are denominated in Colombian pesos, but your revenues, or you have a substantial cash flow in dollars, or it could be vice versa, right? It's just where you've got an FX difference. So what has happened is, yes, the wages that I pay here in Colombia have gone up, but not as much as the dollar. So I'm actually paying less. I'm actually paying less payroll now than I was paying in 2020. Why? Because I have so much cash flow coming in dollars. And if that's what I'm using to pay my my expenses down here, then I'm actually coming out ahead, because the wages have not increased as much as the dollar relative to the peso. And then you say, well, George, you've got peso cash flow as well. And that's true. But my peso cash flow comes from rents. And rents here have gone up more than wages. So listen, it isn't something that I really even like, because, I mean, take that to its logical conclusion. That means the poor middle class, they're getting squeezed. They're getting squeezed. And now, fortunately, I pay my people very, very well. I pay them way higher than normal wages here. So they're still doing well, right? Even in the face of inflation. But, you know, for most people out there, whether it's in the United States or Colombia, that are in the poor and middle class, they're not so lucky. I've been fortunate there, but Keith, that's just one reason why, if you have the resources and if you have the ability, that setting up kind of a geo arbitrage with your cash flows in your portfolio is wise. That's one of the things I say all the time. When you diversify your portfolio, you not only want to diversify the assets as far as that 10-80-10, but ideally you want to diversify your political risk and you want to diversify your currency risk. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I'm selling, or I sold my last U.S. property last week, because A, first and foremost, the price was expensive, so that's time to sell. But B, I had too much dollar cash flow. So I had too much cash flow, period, but I had too much of my overall cash flow is denominated in dollars. So I need to mix that up a little bit just to make sure I'm totally hedged as well as I like to be. On that note, guys, let me do some quick shout outs. I got to get over to the Rebel Capitalist Pro live stream. Who do we have hanging out this evening? Whoa, my goodness, we got a lot of chats here. Holy cow, I can't even get to the bottom. There we go. All right, so we've got Sione Toki. We got Terry. And oh, it skipped on me. Sorry, Terry Baliu. We got Zika Foos 2020, Giovanni Costello, Josh O, Rolf Steiner, Wayne Smith, Speculative Wokenomics, Jason Kincaid, Sustainable Lumber Company in the house, my buddy Joe Schumann, Moody in the house, Frogadelic Research Group, Rigo, Justin Fats, All Nighter Hider, Anthony Court, the OGs in the house tonight, S. Hall, Mike Horseman, Bulldog, Alan Zibelman, Adam Ahmed. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening. We'll see you in the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.